Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to The Next Picture Show, a movie of the week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it's shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Tasha Robinson, here with
Scott Tobias,
Keith Phipps,
and stepping out from behind the production board while Rachel Handler's out of town,
Genevieve Kosky.
We all firmly believe that no film exists in a vacuum and that all culture is more interesting in context. So every other week, we get together to talk over a classic film and consider how it relates to a current release. This week, we have a Capitol Pictures double feature as we look at two Coen Brothers movies made 25 years apart, both about aspects of filmmaking at the same fictional studio. Genevieve, you want to lay out the roadmap for The Life of the Mind?
That's a trick question. There is no roadmap for The Life of the Mind, and exploring it can be painful. But we're going to try. Back in 1991, filmmakers Joel and Ethan Coen had a reputation as dilettantes who tried out a series of genres but hadn't developed a distinct identity yet. Their fourth film, Barton Fink, feels like an answer to the questions critics were asking at the time. It certainly has a strong identity, and it defines who the Coens have always been. It's the story of a screenwriter with writer's block fighting to get words onto paper in a hotel that's disintegrating as fast as his sanity. He's working for a studio called Capitol, the same studio at the center of the Coens' latest film, Hail Caesar. Both movies are about life in the industry and the difficulties of making art, but Barton Fink is a bleak, dark comedy about a single man who's losing his mind, and Hail Caesar is a brisk, light ensemble comedy about an industry where everyone seems like they're on the brink. Come on, Tasha. Two movies about making movies. What do you need? A roadmap?
Man, there's a lot of roadmapping in Barton Fink. Okay, I'll try to draw you one. In the first half of this week's episode, we'll look at Barton Fink and the Coen brothers' history, and we'll share some feedback related to recent episodes. In the second half of the discussion, later in the week, we'll bring Hail Caesar into the mix and discuss how the Coens have changed over the past 25 years and how these two films suggest their perspective on Hollywood has changed. And finally, we'll offer up some recommendations on our closing segment, Your Next Picture Show. But first, let's all remind ourselves, we create! We create for a living! We're creators!
We're creators!
Celebrating the completion of something good! Do you understand that, Taylor?
Beat it, creator!
Come on, buddy. Give the Navy a dance.
Let somebody else spin the day!
Step aside, 4 eyes!
Hey, 4F! Take a hike!
Suck an egg!
Hey, don't sit on a tomato!
I'm a writer, you monsters! I create! I create for a living! I'm a creator! I am a creator!
Screw me!
This is my uniform! This is how I serve the common man! This is where I...
Barton Fink has an interesting distinction. It was the first movie to win multiple major awards at the Cannes Film Festival, which at the time habitually restricted those awards to one per movie. After the Coens walked off with the Palme d'Or and a shared Best Director award, while their star, John Turturro, won Best Actor, the festival altered the judging rules so a given film could only win a maximum of two awards. Barton Fink was the first and last Cannes awards sweep, and when it hit American theaters after Cannes, it was a critical hit as well. And yet it barely featured at the Oscars that year, and was a certified flop at the box office. The Coen brothers are very distinctive, idiosyncratic filmmakers who make unusually textured movies full of sharp, striking images and unusual characters, but they aren't always accessible. And they've rarely been less accessible than they were with Barton Fink, a weird, sour, claustrophobic little comedy about a weird, sour, claustrophobic little man. This isn't a film for everyone. It's visually dark and oppressive, and its central character is a man who's failing at what many audience members may see as a dream job, banging out a simple script for a Hollywood studio. The Coens' latest movie, Hail Caesar, is much more of a crowd pleaser. It's full of big stars like George Clooney, Josh Brolin, Scarlett Johansson, and Channing Tatum, all playing big, broad roles in a story that's nominally about the troubles of Hollywood. But where screenwriter Barton Fink seems to hate his sellout job, Hail Caesar is a big, enthusiastic love letter to the industry. It acknowledges that filmmakers are a bunch of difficult egotists, but the Coens spent so much time looking at all the energy that actually appears on the big screen that the steps behind the screen seem comparatively small and untroubled. Maybe that's because of where the two films came from. The Coens wrote Barton Fink, a story about writer's block, while they were trying to overcome writer's block back at the beginning of the 1990s. It's an angry, insular film about the insides of their own heads and how professionally stymied they felt at the time. But Hail Caesar is a look back to a stylized, idealized Hollywood golden age. It's set in an indeterminate period in the 1940s or 50s, where the studio system was pumping out classics, no matter how many scandals were getting covered up off-screen or reshaped to fit the studio's needs. It's a nostalgia piece, openly inspired by bright memories of the classics. The funny thing is, Barton Fink is a period piece as well, set in 1941, but it spends so little time outside of its hotel room that the era hardly matters. Roadmap or no, it's about the life of the mind, not the life of the studio. Looking at two Coen brothers films made 25 years apart, but both dealing with the same industry and the same imaginary studio, in something like the same era, seems like a perfect opportunity to dig into how the filmmakers have changed over the course of their career, how often they come back to the same issues of disintegration and chaos, and how they veer back and forth from film to film at deciding whether to take a comic or nihilistic look at those forces and what they mean, and how they affect people who either feel them deeply or are too blithe and happily ignorant to understand the weight of the world. The Coens have addressed traditional dramas and offbeat comedies with the same level of skill, but their films suggest wildly different worldviews while still coming from the same familiar film-obsessed perspectives. So when this film came out, the Coen brothers had made three films, a comedy, a gangster film, and a neo-noir. And you would think that critics would respond to that favorably. You know, here are a couple of guys who are doing all sorts of things and doing them all well. But I've read all of these pieces from the time that are very down on the Coens as not knowing what they want to do, not having a signature yet. And then along comes Barton Fink, which seems very idiosyncratic, but also really weird. Do you guys remember how you reacted to it the first time you saw it?
Yes, actually, it's very strange to hear you talk about their earlier films as being not that well received or having some trouble with critics, because I had the complete opposite impression. By the time Barton Fink showed up at the local multiplex, which at this time I was in college, this would have been in Athens, Georgia, you know, the Coens were absolutely worshipped among, you know, the Coens and Hal Hartley were the two filmmakers that all of my college cinephile friends were really gravitating towards. So it's very strange to think that, you know, I know that Roger Ebert wrote a fairly high profile negative review of Raising Arizona, for example, but Miller's Crossing and Blood Simple were both quite well received. Am I wrong?
It's not that they weren't individually well received. It's that if you go back and look at specifically, like I think it was Vincent Canby in The Times says something specifically about how they make distinctive movies, but they haven't distinguished themselves. Like it's not clear who they are
yet. They didn't have that Coen brothers feeling yet.
Oh, right. I on the one hand, I'm not sure I even know what that means. On the other hand, though, I think sometimes it's more in the writing. There's a lot of stylistically moving from genre to genre, but the writing is so distinctively Coen brothers in all those first four films and all the subsequent films. So it seems like a very odd thing to say. I mean, just having rewatched Raising Arizona recently, and you can kind of see, you know, I think the Coens now, and even by the time of Barton Fink, there's not really, even by the time of Miller's Crossing, there really is not a wasted moment or a wasted shot or a wasted line. Raising Arizona still has a little bit of that, I think, and there's some scenes that, like, I'm not really sure what they contribute, as funny as they are. But nonetheless, the style of the writing, the voices of the characters, and sort of these overarching themes, you know, the relationship between happiness and money, which is, I think, comes something that you can point to in almost every single Coen brothers movie. They're all already in place very early on.
But, I mean, did Barton Fink itself stand out for you as a film? Do you remember seeing it for the first time?
I remember seeing it for the first time. I probably didn't see it until it was at the video store. I remember seeing Raising Arizona in the theater. And then I don't know if Miller's Crossing played Dayton, Ohio. I know that was something I discovered on, oh, these guys have a movie. I think is sort of my, no, I knew about it through Premiere Magazine, but I don't think I didn't get a chance to see it in the theater. Barton Fink, yeah, I think it was a video store thing. And I remember thinking, this is a movie I'm going to watch over and over again. And I have actually, you know, it's a movie I revisited a lot. And part of why I like it is there's no figuring it out. There's mysteries to it. You know, no matter how many times you see it, that's part of what I appreciated about it. And I find my feelings about it shifting a little bit over the years, too. I think I was a little more sympathetic to Barton when I was younger than I am now.
I'm glad I didn't know you when you were younger.
Well, I don't know if that reflects badly. That may reflect badly on me now, though. You know, it's like,
yeah, that's a whole separate question that I'd love to get into. But first, Genevieve, what are your early impressions of Barton Fink?
Well, I will spare telling you guys how old I was when Barton Fink came out in theaters, but suffice to say, I wasn't really cognizant of what the critical community thought of it at the time. I was more concerned with like Beauty and the Beast at that point. But so the first time I saw it, I saw it for the first time at the exact wrong time, because I had just kind of become aware of the Coen brothers through Oh Brother Where Art Thou and Big Lebowski, which both happened like in
late 90s
toward the end of my high school career. So I saw Barton Fink for the first time in college. And at that point, those were the only two kind of Coen brothers experiences I had. And it just was so weird. Like I had no way to contextualize it. I did not connect to it in any way, really, except thinking like that was really weird and maybe felt like a bit of a waste of my time because I just wasn't at the right spot for it, I think. The second time I saw it several years later and was a much more advanced movie watcher and Coen Brothers appreciator, it made a lot more sense in the way we're talking about now in the context of the Coen Brothers career. And then just rewatching it again for this podcast, it kind of opened a new level of appreciation for it as a film about filmmaking, and obviously watching it with Hail Caesar amplified that. So it's like you said, it's kind of a movie that reveals different aspects of itself to you every time.
Yeah, for me, I mean, I just associate it so strongly with some of the other films that I was discovering that year, like Delicatessen and some of David Lynch's stuff. I do associate the Coens with Hal Hartley specifically because he was so big at the time, mm-hmm. and because I discovered them at the same time. The manic humor of Raising Arizona was so delightful to me that I, like, there was a period of probably 5 years where every time I went into a film of theirs, I was looking for that and was kind of baffled when I didn't get it. And this film is not a film to walk into expecting Raising Arizona. It's just, I mean, it's more like Delicatessen. It's just, it's so dark. It's so weird. It's so oppressive in so many ways. And I remember being really disappointed with it the first time out in a way that, you know, once you both know what you're expecting and have more of a sense for the Coens' tastes and what they're trying to say, like, that disappointment isn't there at all. It's just, it's purely an expectations thing.
I actually have a very distinct memory of where I was when I saw this film. What I remember seeing it at this mall multiplex and just it being over and just standing in the parking lot, not getting in my car for a while, just utterly shaken by the experience of seeing it because that last third is just such a mind bleep. See, if we're going to keep this a family podcast, I'm going to say mind bleep. And it really is, I guess, dark and oppressive as the first half of the film is. It still doesn't quite lead you to that point. The film does kind of go off that cliff, and it still to this day does make you think about what does it all mean? What is mm-hmm. it? And I guess maybe we'll sort that out the last third of the movie, but it certainly doesn't go in an expected place, and it goes to a very disturbing place. Because I think one thing we haven't talked about, and maybe we will in terms of our first reactions to it, is that it is a really funny film for a good chunk. I mean, there is a lot of comedy in there involving, you know, stuff involving Michael Lerner and John Polito and
Tony Shalhoub
mm-hmm. is amazing as Ben Geisler.
Geisler?
And Chet? What
Geisler,
about Chet?
You say Geisler.
Chet. Doesn't everyone like Chet?
Chet's the
funny looking guy.
Yep. Are you a, what is it? Are you a, res or a...
res or trans.
Res or trans.
That joke plays so differently today.
I think the last shot is hilarious too, but I guess we'll get into that when we talk about the ending too.
Well, there's certainly that, but also just John Goodman. I mean, the rhythms of the conversations that Goodman and Turturro have in one or the other of their hotel rooms, like, play as such bleak, dark comedy today. And when you go in without expectation, without like understanding how the film is going to work, some of the stuff that comes across in those scenes is incredibly uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And you kind of have to get to a point where you've seen it and you know where it's all going before those conversations become a little more tolerable. I mean, even rewatching them this time, I still found them kind of excruciating, like in a good way, like in a very emotionally moving way because they're so well crafted, so well put together. But there's still just like this dark or undercurrent of like hilarity to the way Turturro keeps cutting Goodman off and keeps not understanding like the irony of everything coming out of his mouth.
Watching this most recent time, I was kind of like developing a complicated theory that I'm sure I'm not the first person to suggest, that the hotel is hell and Charlie is Satan. Mm-hmm. And I was watching it all through that lens, which just made that character and John Goodman's performance so much more delightful than it already was, which is saying something. And I don't think that metaphor completely hangs together, but it is an interesting lens through which to view that character and kind of all of John Goodman's characters for the Coens. He is one of their regulars who I think thrives in a very specific type.
Boy, my first thought is his character in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, and how well that fits into that theory.
For sure.
At the same time, I find, you know, Charlie's vulnerability really moving in a way for a likely serial killer.
But
at the same time, but it's, every time, like, he talks about being insulted and all this stuff, but he's also, the one of the stories that gets cut off is obviously him, you know, trading sex for a late payment. Like, he's talking about it in the most casual way possible, this really detestable act. It's a fascinating character.
And I was, all of those stories of his, I was viewing as him testing Barton, because I feel like their whole relationship, all of those conversations they have, and it's always Barton's hotel room. We never see Charlie's room
either. Oh, is that true?
Yeah. Which adds a level of mystery to his character. But anyway, like, all those conversations they have, it all seems to be Charlie goading Barton into asking him questions. Like, Charlie is presenting himself like, I am the common man. I am the common man that you are talking all this highfalutin language about. I could tell you stories. I could tell you stories. Like, he says that many times, and it's just there. It's waiting for Barton to be like, tell me one of those stories. Or he knows all about wrestling pictures. He loves wrestling pictures, and Barton's
and
having
trouble wrestling.
Yeah, and Barton's having trouble writing a wrestling picture, and it never even occurs to him to ask Charlie something.
Strange as it may seem, Charlie, I guess I write about people like you, the average working stiff, the common man.
Well, ain't that a kick in the head?
Yeah, I guess it is. But in a way, that's exactly the point. There's a few people in New York, hopefully our numbers are growing, who feel we have an opportunity now to forge something real out of everyday experience. Create a theater for the masses based on a few simple truths, not on some shop-worn abstractions about drama that don't hold true today if they ever did. I don't guess this means much to you.
Hell yeah, I could tell you some stories.
And that's the point. That we all have stories. The hopes and dreams of the common man are as noble as those of any king.
And I feel like that character exists to highlight the sort of artistic vanity that Barton Fink has, that I think is his central flaw as a character, and is a flaw that I think the Coens return to several times. The Coens character that Barton Fink reminds me most of is Llewyn Davis, just as far as being so stuck in their own perception of themselves as an artist or as a creator that they are totally blinded to the realities of their situation.
And also just having a tremendous arrogance about him, like an arrogance that everybody finds off-putting that he's unaware of.
Yeah.
Though I would say the difference, though, is that Llewyn Davis is a legitimately talented artist. I mean, the music that he creates is excellent. And I think you could look at Barton's work and think this is just pretentious junk. He can't really speak.
I mean, he banged out a script in an entire night.
I don't think he can really speak for the
fishmongers. And also there's like and also, you know, I think there's kind of this element, a very strong element of self-deprecation to Barton Fink that may not be present in Llewyn Davis. You know, this was a film that grew out of writer's block on Miller's Crossing specifically. And I think this was kind of one of those situations where the Coens were presenting their worst possible image of themselves on screen. But
I think, getting back to the question of whether Barton Fink is talented or not, I think, like so much in this movie, the Coens do not give us enough evidence to make a judgment.
Right.
We see a snippet of the end and the audience likes it. And we know his character. When we get to know Barton, we know he knows nothing about the common man, but it's separating the creation from the work. Maybe the work is fantastic, you know, even if it's not necessarily informed by firsthand knowledge or even the kind of sympathy you think he would need to have. Toward the end, maybe he's turned out a brilliant script. We don't know. We know it ends the exact same way his play does, which is not necessarily evidence for that. But I think there's so much withholding of information or so much teasing of information in this movie. I think that's part of what makes it so intriguing and so rewatchable and so discussable.
And this is something I'll get more into in the second segment when we talk about Coen characters. But I think a lot of that is the fact that Barton doesn't really have a backstory. A lot of Coen characters don't know where they were before the story started, you know? And like, I think Coen characters tend to function more as storytelling elements than as people, as recognizable people. And like I said, we don't really know anything about Barton Fink going into this other than that he wrote a a play and people liked it. You know, like maybe he does come from the common man and he has strayed from it. But that is not something the Coens are interested in exploring, I don't think. They are interested in the character so far as it applies to the story they are trying to tell in this film.
I mean, I think there's a distinct feeling that he is a Jewish New York intellectual. He is a very specific type, and that he's self-hating in all of those things and wants to associate himself with the common man without necessarily understanding what that is. Mm-hmm. But I'm with Keith. I think he hit the nail on the head. Inside Llewyn Davis hands you his art like on a platter and lets you experience it for yourself and judge it for yourself. Mm-hmm. And it's beautiful. It's presented as beautiful. People react to it as though it's beautiful. But so much of it is withheld within Barton Fink that you're kind of left to judge him through the lens of how he judges himself and how he presents himself, which is not always the best way to appreciate an artist. But I want to circle back to what Keith was talking about sympathy and kind of how our sympathies change. Because rewatching this, I think I had the same experience where the first time I saw it, I sympathized more with Barton Fink being in this horrible hotel in this horrible situation, the discomfort of writer's block, the helplessness of being told to produce in an environment where he's not really clear on what he's trying to produce. This time around, rewatching it, I think Keith and I are both coming from the perspective of people who have spent decades as editors, and we know what it's like to be waiting for a piece that doesn't come in because the guy's like, I'm having difficulties, which I can't express and which are not in any way related to the fact that you have a picture that you need to make. Like, I don't think that we're meant to sympathize with any of the studio flacks or studio heads that we see. But I do think as people who write for a living, even though we've probably all experienced that writer's block, we're maybe a little less inclined to deeply sympathize with somebody who ignores every avenue of aid that's presented to him because he's so caught up in like his own sympathy for himself in his life of the mind.
Yeah, and I think the editing thing is a good comparison because it's like you have a very specific assignment. I know what I want. I want you to put your own voice on it, but please give me what I'm looking for.
But also as an editor, you would never assign a writer who has no background or interest in the subject you want a piece written about. And that is, I think, where the criticism of, you know, film industry, especially at this particular point in time, comes from. But I just put it on the record, I'm right there with you guys. I find Barton kind of insufferable for a lot of the same reasons.
I will say in terms of shifting sympathies, though, if you are a 17, 18-year-old kid whose brains are their best aspect, and you have literary interests and a perhaps overdeveloped sense of integrity, you're not going to be with him all the way through the movie, but you at least kind of see where he's coming from. You know, maybe be a little more sympathetic to where he is, and perhaps a little later in life when you have a little more experience of how the world works.
Make your deadlines.
But there's a moment early in the film that I didn't catch till this most recent time through that just sets that like insufferable aspect of his character in stone. And it's like right at the very beginning when he's talking with, I think, his agent, the one who tells him to go out to Hollywood. And he's giving his whole spiel about, you know, I want to create a new type of theater. And he's talking all this big game about his lofty ideals. And then just as an aside, his agent, I hope it's his agent, I'm going to assume it's his agent, says, like, did you see so-and-so's review? And his Barnes & Noble response is, no, what did it say? Like, there's this just, like, immediate undercutting of everything he is saying about himself. And I think that just this time through set for me a certain like baseline level of disgust with Barton as a character while still thinking he is a fabulous character and like this is a wonderful movie. Like, by no means is an unsympathetic character a bad character.
For me, that disgust mostly comes from his first long conversation with John Goodman, where there's you get the sense when he's talking to his agent about wanting to make a difference that his humility is real. Like, he really does believe that it would be arrogant of him to overpraise his own work. But when he's talking to Goodman, that shifts. And all of a sudden, he's talking about, you know, people like you. I want to relate to people like you. And there's a condescension in that and in the way he keeps cutting Goodman off and dismissing him and ignoring him and the way he can't see his naked loneliness that just becomes very off-putting. And it's a very subtle thing that I think I just wasn't equipped to comprehend as a teenager.
Just as a real quick aside, and I'm maybe displaying my ignorance here, but were wrestling pictures a thing? Like, I can't think of any wrestling pictures. from that era. What, but I am not super well.
Hell in 10 square feet.
Yeah. I'm just like really fascinated by this supposed B-movie genre of wrestling pictures.
I'm not an expert on this. They were not as common as boxing pictures, but I believe Faulkner, who was the inspiration for J.P. Mayhew, actually worked on a wrestling picture.
Did it have a dame or
an orphan?
Why not both?
I remember reading something that, you know, the Coens kind of did no research for this. It was all just kind of going from their general perception. So I kind of liked the idea that they just made up a genre for this.
Yeah, there's such a strange thing with them. They don't much like talking about their work, and they are probably pretty close to top of my list of people who I watch their film, and then I want to know what they say about their work. And then if they actually do an interview, I think I wish I didn't know that. I wish I hadn't read that.
Accept the mystery, as to quote a serious man. Accept the mystery. You know, one thing to go.
Look at the parking lot.
Look at the parking to go back a little bit in terms of the characters and trying to distinguish them. I think there's a lot of respect, and we see this more with Hail Caesar, for people who get things done. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's kind of a distinction that needs to be made, not just between Barton and the studio, but Barton and the Lerner's character, I can't remember his name, the head of the studio, and then Ben Geisler. I think they have a tremendous amount of respect for the Ben Geisler type, and of course the Mannix type from Hail Caesar, who just executes, and that is their job, and that is what they're going to do. I think you know, with this whole assignment, I mean, Barton is kind of set up to fail, because they don't know that the sense is that, given that he writes about the common man, that perhaps the wrestling picture is what he's best suited to do, but he doesn't know that. He doesn't know that, and as Ben Geisler said, you know, he forgot about him before he even left the meeting. So I think there's a different level of, you know, respect that I think the Coens have for professionalism, for people who get things done.
And I think that's interesting. That's an interesting take in terms of their career, because they put out movies pretty regularly, you know, like they haven't had a huge creative lull, you know, and the fact that they are able to remain as idiosyncratic as they are is exceptional, but they get it done. They get it done their way, which is something that Barton Fink is not able to do. But maybe that is kind of the point in what they were wrestling with here.
No, he does sort of get it done his way. I mean, there's every sense that he does, in fact, sit down and bang out a picture that is all of the things he wants out of that script, even though it has nothing to do with what the studio wants. And I think realizing that it ends the exact same way may give us a hint that he's just kind of reproduced his first success. But at least he has created something that satisfies his life of the mind. I mean, it takes him forever to get there, and he spends an awful lot of time. I think it's really important that when he's looking to other people for guidance, when he's looking to his favorite author, when he's looking to the studio head, he keeps asking, like, maybe you could, like, sort of lead me through what I'm supposed to be doing. He gets nowhere. And then when he sits down and possibly just reproduces what he's already done, like, he's perfectly happy with it, because he's going inside his own mind for once and just doing, like, what's important to him.
And maybe that also is an autobiographical thing as well. I mean, the Coen brothers, I'm sure they suffered through making Miller's Crossing, and when they finished Miller's Crossing, it was a Coen brothers picture, right? And which is not for everybody. They're incapable of making films, I think, for everybody. I mean, they try sometimes with The Lady Killers, and even, I mean, Hail Caesar, you could say it's a universal picture. You know, they're trying to reach some sort of a larger audience, but they're too strange for it. They can't do a Capitol Pictures B movie. That's not their style, and it's maybe not Barton's style.
And yet they connect it with the widest possible audience with a musical set in the South filled with...
Right, that is the movie that introduced me to the Coen brothers. Well, I could think about that.
And I think a lot of people... It played forever in the South, that movie. And, you know, I think it was much bigger success than anyone had anticipated. And why? It's very odd, highly stylized, extremely Coen brothers movie.
It's a version of the Odyssey.
Yeah, I was going to say it's the Odyssey.
And it's strange to me that Hail Caesar seems not, well, I don't want to get too far ahead, but seems not to connect with audiences, because, and actually actively not connected with audiences, who gave it a C-minus cinema score, which is sort of impossible to get. because it is fun, and it is kind of a crowd pleaser. So I don't know if there's any predicting what's going to work for the Coen brothers.
Well, let's talk about what makes a Coen brothers film. I mean, there's so much in this movie. One of the things that comes home most to me, I guess, is just the rhythm when the two cops are interrogating Barton Fink. There's a rhythm to the way that they play off of each other that immediately brought up for me, like, the Hudsucker Proxy, the ad people talking in the Hudsucker Proxy. There's so many actors here that we see over and over in Coen brothers movies that kind of the sharpness of, like, even the dim, dilapidated hotel just has this very Coen brothers look to it. Scott, you were the one who said, you know, they sat down and made a Coen brothers movie. What does a Coen brothers movie mean to you at this point?
I mean, it means different things. I think the films they were making in that era are different than what they're making now. As much as there are connections between Hail Caesar and Barton Fink, you know, A Serious Man is really, or something like that, that doesn't seem like something they were capable of doing or that you would expect from that at all back when they made Barton Fink. You know, the line against them critically was that their stuff was too mannered and too
cerebral,
too mechanical, too mannered, too cerebral, I suppose, maybe a little too cartoonish. But I think there is kind of a sense with Barton Fink and the rhythms of the dialogue in a film like Raising Arizona, or certainly Miller's Crossing, of just sort of a way to reconcile older patterns of dialogue or the sorts of banter that you would hear, you know, in films from the 40s and 50s and in noir or something like that with our modern day, you know, try to bring it up to the late 20th century in their own way. I mean, that's one of the things that kind of stands out for me, I guess, about their earlier work, which I think is, again, a little different than what they did, what they're doing now.
His name is Charlie Meadows.
Yeah, and I'm Buck Rogers.
Name's Munt, Carl Munt.
Also known as Madman Munt.
A little funny in the head.
What did he...
Funny.
As in, he likes to ventilate people with a shotgun and then cut their heads off.
Yeah, he's funny, that word.
Started in Kansas City. Couple housewives.
Couple of days ago, we got the same M.O. out in Los Feliz.
Doctor. Ear, nose, and throat man.
All of which is now missing.
Well, some of his throat was still there.
Physician, heal thyself.
Good luck with no f***ing head.
Anyway.
Hollywood precinct finds another stiff yesterday. Not too far from here. This one's better looking than the doc.
Female Caucasian, about 30 years old. Nice, no head. Ever seen Munt with anyone fits that description?
But, you know, with the head still on.
Tasha, not to play like the Lipnick to your Barton Fink and stroke your ego here, but, you know, you wrote a piece for The Dissolve about the morality of Coen films, and that, you know, you kind of joked at the time that it was your unifying theory of Coen brothers movies. And I thought that was a great piece. And it certainly helped firm up in my mind what I think a Coen brothers movie is, which is very fixated on this idea of crime and punishment. And I use crime loosely, maybe sin and punishment, you know, just kind of heaping abuse or having characters heap abuse on themselves and seeing how it shakes out that's come to define in my mind what a Coen brothers film is. And like that, the sin can be something very simple, like the sin of vanity or, you know, but it still becomes a central part of how you read any given film of theirs.
Yeah, for me, the nut of that piece was always that it's not necessarily about violating some universal constant rule. Like, it's not about the Ten Commandments necessarily. It's about people's individual morality, and that individual morality is the only way to get through like a serious situation. And I want to talk a little more about kind of that piece and Coen brothers' morality, which to me still is kind of the unified field theory. But first, Keith, did you have any thoughts on what makes a Coen brothers movie?
You know, I, in some ways, just to give a slightly different answer than other people are giving, I think in some ways it is the crew that they've assembled and the elements that are the same across. Like, I think Carter Burwell is so integral to what they do. I mean, he makes, from the beginning, he's written these wonderful scores. I mean, just to point to a different movie, but in Fargo, I think so much of the tone of that movie is established by this, you know, heavy theme that plays as these headlights go over this snowy landscape. And it's like, this is a middle of nowhere place where something big is going to happen. Like, this story is out of the way among people you probably don't encounter in real life very often, but what happens here matters. And I think, you know, Burwell does a wonderful job here as well in terms of Deakins being their main cinematographer, although Inside Llewyn Davis is a wonderful movie, a wonderful looking movie he didn't shoot, but he just seems like so in sync with what they do. this Roderick Janes who edits their films.
So talented.
So Coen-esque in his or her editing.
Such an elusive guy, too.
You never see him. It's interesting.
I think you should probably explain that just for...
to explain that Roderick Janes is the pseudonym under which the Coen brothers edit their own films. But I mean, you know, there is, you know, as for as much as they skip across genres and styles and even tones, you know, I mean, Burn After Reading and A Serious Man, or I believe there was back to back, and you know, could not, in many ways, could not be more tonally different films. There is a Coen touch. I mean, a lot of it's in the dialogue, but so much also is sort of the craftsmanship that they and the people they work with bring to whatever they do. Repertory Company as well. You know, it's great to see. You know, it's fun to see them, how they use the same actors in different roles across different movies.
Yeah, and I think they really get more use out of their staple of actors, even than somebody like Christopher Guest, who uses the same ensemble over and over, but you see them playing sort of similar roles because they're playing to their strengths. You know, you're going to see a wider variety of roles out of like Steve Buscemi or John Goodman than you necessarily are out of like Catherine O'Hara or Fred Willard, you know, which is nothing against O'Hara or Fred Willard. They're both hilarious actors, but I kind of see the same roles out of them over and over. And I feel like the Coens just have a really strong sense of like how far they can stretch the actors that they work with over and over.
To expand a little bit on a point Keith was making too, about, you know, he talked about music, but I think broadly speaking, you could talk about their films as having a musicality generally. I mean, there's nothing out of place in a Coen Brothers film. I mean, you could call it mechanical, but I think it's...
meticulous.
It's meticulous. It's actually very pleasing to watch. Their films are endlessly rewatchable, not just because they're mysterious, but because the craft is just so on point at all times.
Well,
you know?
And Barton Fink just has so many indelible images. Like, I could probably name like a half dozen images from that film that I think you could point to as a quintessential Coen Brothers shot, like the shoes lined up in the hallway, or the woman looking out over the waves, or him looking at the woman looking out over the waves, you know, and the meticulousness on display, and like every frame says something about the film, about the story being told.
I mean, even Barton Fink's look is just, it's so weird and iconic. And it reminds me more than anything. I associate this film very strongly with David Lynch's Eraserhead. Mm-hmm. And part of it just
the hair.
Oh, yeah.
That's a great comparison. Why didn't I think that?
Well, it used the sound as well.
And it's just visceral.
The long, uncomfortable pauses, the sense of discomfort in the disintegrating environment, but also just that iconic image of the guy with the weird tall hair and the narrow face and the blank, frightened eyes because he's going through this completely untenable nightmare situation.
Oh, you're killing me. That's such a great comparison. There's so much, there's so many parallels there.
I think that hotel room is more viscerally unsettling than anything in Eraserhead. Like, just anytime he's in his room, poking at the wet, gluey wallpaper, watching the bug, like I get so, like, I'm uncomfortable right now just talking about it. Like, I don't know. And
you just know the air is stale.
Yeah.
And the mattress is terrible.
And one of my favorite little details, and this is such a Coen-esque detail, is when he walks in the room for the first time and he's looking around and he sees a pad of paper with a pencil on it. Moves the pencil aside, and like the sunlight has faded an outline around the pencil, and it's like no writing has taken place in this room in a long, long time.
Possibly nobody has been in this room in a long, long time. I mean, not only can you feel that the air is stale, you can feel that it's just like clogged with dust and the smell of everybody who's ever been in that room.
See, now this makes me want to defend Chet for a second. Because Chet is there for you at all times. And he pretty much is the only guy running the entire hotel.
Why does Chet hang out under the floorboards? What's under there?
There's a whole world under the hotel.
There should be a whole other movie about the secret life of Chet.
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of mysteries we haven't even tackled in this discussion. I'll throw out one. What does Heil Hitler mean in the context of that final sequence?
That's an excellent question, and I don't know. I mean, I take it to be just a further indication. Well, it could be a further indication that he's Satan. Yeah. Although, I don't love the Satan theory because I feel like he's much more patient. Both that he's more patient than Satan would be.
Well, I'm viewing it more as like the Lucifer version of Satan, like the kind of the charmer, the fallen angel, the yin to God's yang.
But there's just something so human.
The Lewis Cipher.
Now, he's a much, much slicker. Mm-hmm. Again, we should explain that that's from Angel Heart.
Angel Heart, yeah.
But I don't know. There's just something, the combination of like naked vulnerability and like visible frustration and friendliness, I guess could work into a version of Satan. But to me, what makes it interesting is that he's so human. And that Heil Hitler for me is just kind of a screw you of, you know, yeah, I'm crazy and I know it. It's just, it's like a little like period tacked on to the end of the sentence that is burning down the hotel and killing both of the cops.
Yeah, I feel like, with all due respect to the hell and Satan theory, I feel like this is a movie that kind of loses something if when you try to do too many X equals Y things with it. You know,
I don't mean to suggest that it is a working theory. It's just an interesting lens through which to view that character.
Yeah, and the degree to which reality kind of slips away, not just from him, but I think from the entire movie, I think is pretty fascinating as well. I think you're on unsteady ground throughout this film.
Well, I do want to get back to the morality question, because when I wrote that piece, the unified field theory of Coen Brothers' morality, I remember one of the comments on that piece being somebody who wrote in really angry with me because he felt that Barton Fink, he, she, I don't even know.
It's a he. Go ahead.
Oh, did you read this comment?
No, I'm just saying that definitely is a he. But
angry and opinionated about Barton Fink but equals man.
Yelling at somebody on the internet.
Okay. So this person felt that one of the biggest, stupidest flaws in my theory was that Barton Fink, I said that, you know, the fatal flaw that he has is that he sold out his talent for this thing that he doesn't believe in, and he's being punished in the way so many Coen Brothers characters are punished for even the most minor infractions against God or themselves or their beliefs. And this person felt that there's no indication that he's talented at all. And I feel like that's something we've sort of covered here, is the ambiguity of it. But there is a sense that, you know, some people certainly appreciate his work. They may be like the rarefied New York intellectual Broadway theater goers, as opposed to the working men that he feels he wants to appeal to. But there is some reason to believe that he has a talent. I'm sort of curious whether, like, do you think that he's being punished here? Do you think he's done something wrong? Or is this an absurdist story? Like, does it have a meaning to it?
One thing I would say immediately is that I don't think you have to be talented, right? And that's, I mean, why do you have to be talented? Why do you have to be talented to sell out? I don't think the two things are really related. I think you have to have principles that you sell out, but that doesn't necessarily, and certainly Barton has strong principles that he is happy to share, you know, with anybody within earshot. But that doesn't necessarily mean that he's talented. I don't think that is actually kind of irrelevant to the discussion. So that's my comment to that guy's going to feel a burn now.
What he needed was another man to put him in his place.
He needed me to put him in his place. But no, I don't think that's really. I don't think it's really relevant whether he's talented. I think it's relevant that he has principles.
Well, I mean, I guess regardless of his talent, is this a morality play to you to the degree that it is to me? Like, do you think that he's done something and earned his time in hell? Or is this just a horrible universe where horrible things happen? Is a bad thing happening to a bad person here? Is a bad thing happening to just a completely random person who happened to be in the wrong place?
I think to go back to the metaphor that we all think doesn't quite work, I think a hotel is where he is being tested, and he fails in that test because, you know, as I talked about with Charlie kind of giving him all these opportunities to prove himself and to walk the talk, and him not recognizing that. But I just had this thought when you were talking about the idea of selling out and how it kind of plays into his obsession with the common man. And theater, New York theater, or any theater really, is not the venue for the common man. Like, theater is expensive. You know, your average blue-collar worker does not go see a lot of plays. You know, film is the medium of the common man. That is where, you know, someone could pay, I don't know, 50 cents or whatever. I don't know what a movie ticket ran that time, and go see a story. So by appealing to him to come to Hollywood and write films, he is being asked to write for the common man, to make content for the common man. And he's not able to do that because of his own failings, whether moral or just ignorance, or I don't quite know. But I kind of think of the hotel as being his purgatory / proving ground, and it becomes hell literally at the end when he fails to live up to that challenge.
But I mean, to keep this in the metaphorical zone, I mean, with the hotel, though, isn't the hotel sort of the life of the mind? I mean, in terms of being something separate from him, instead of thinking about the hotel as being separate from Barton, wouldn't we think about the hotel as being
his own deteriorating mind?
Yeah, I mean, right, yeah. Exactly, being much more reflective of him punishing himself and him going through this process, and the hotel itself being very much a reflection of his internal machinations, not this separate place that he goes to, but that is, you know, him.
Yeah, I mean, I really feel that's true. And that's why the Heil Hitler at the end doesn't interest me nearly as much as the fact that as Goodman is like storming down the hallway, burning it down and coming for the policeman, he's screaming, "I'll show you the life of the mind," over and over. Mm. I'm curious, how do you interpret that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can I just say how annoyed I am that the DVD of Barton Fink has that scene as the menu scene,
oh my God,
like playing in the background?
DVD manufacturers, stop doing this.
Even Criterion with the inside Llewyn Davis, I was showing to my wife who had never seen it before, and I you know, played it because you know, they always give too much away, and I watched it later, and they had the where's the scrotum scene right there on the biggest laugh in the movie right there on the DVD menu.
Why do you do that? Like, the trailers often have to have the big explosion at the end or the surprise twist or whatever in them to get people in the door. If you've already got the DVD at home, you don't need the biggest movie moment in the movie spoiled for you by the DVD menu.
This is why physical media should be abolished, right? We all agree on that.
Thanks for lending me your copy of Barton Fink.
Yeah, says the man at the table who probably owns the most Blu-rays of any of us.
Possibly. I'll shoot life in mind. I interpret that. I don't interpret it. I don't know what to make of that. Yeah, it could just be sort of.
Who is he saying it to? Like, well, I'm just saying, like,
he's presumably not saying it to the cops. Like, yeah. It means nothing to them.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it can be just sort of a I'm going to show you who you really are. It means essentially the same thing.
It's just, for me, that becomes so baffling, because if he was there to punish Barton Fink himself, like if that ended with him shooting him, I would see that sequence as, you know, him coming for revenge of like everything he feels he's suffered at Barton's hands, being belittled and embarrassed and threatened in his own room. And as it is, it's like, I don't know, there's the scene with the writer where Barton says that suffering is necessary to create art, that, you know, all art comes out of suffering. And the writer's like, I just like making things up. And it seems to me like Goodman is saying, you know, I'm bringing suffering to you because this is what you think you want. Because afterwards, he's so conciliatory. You know, he's so kind. He feels like he's tearing down his value system one moment, and then he's supporting him the next.
They say I'm a madman, Barton, but I'm not mad at anyone. Honest, I'm not. Most guys I just feel sorry for. It tears me up inside to think about what they're going through, how trapped they are. I understand it. I feel for them. So I try and help them out. Jesus. Yeah. Yeah. I know what it feels like when things get all balled up at the head office. It puts you through hell, Barton. So I help people out. I just wish someone would do as much for me. Jesus, it's hot.
But I think that you can almost say with the Coens, though, in the ending of that movie, that they were almost embracing the idea of abstraction as a concept. Mm. Because they had, with Raising Arizona, they had that component, I think, in Leonard Smalls, which is kind of the first...
The biker from hell?
The biker from hell, who was, you know, this kind of quasi dreamlike character.
Nicolas Cage character dreams him first, and then he appears.
Right, exactly. Which is a very abstract idea, but I think Barton Fink was kind of that thing. Like, we can do that, and we can just take that all the way, mm-hmm. and leave audiences to deal with it. I don't know. It's very hard. You know, I think the proper response is that accept the mystery thing is it's fun to puzzle over, as we have done, but as meticulously planned as their movies are, I don't see them leaving the ending of Barton Fink as a mystery that is solvable.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the ending of A Serious Man is much more ambiguous and difficult and confusing than the ending of this movie. This movie, I think this ending is perfect. Okay, well, speaking of perfect endings, I hate to give myself the last word on Barton Fink, but we've still got to get to feedback, and we've been talking about this film for nearly an hour. So we've got more Barton Fink talk to come up in the second part of this this week's podcast. But in the meantime, I would like to share some listener feedback, starting with a recommendation for a film that might make a good triple feature with our picks from the last episode, The Martian and John Carter, a.k.a. John Carter of Mars. Keith, you'd actually suggested the film that this listener suggested as a possible pairing with The Martian. You want to read the letter?
Absolutely. Christopher Reese writes in to say he doesn't understand the negativity around John Carter, but thinks we could have picked a better match, a 1964 movie that was mostly forgotten until the Criterion Edition came out. He writes, Robinson Crusoe on Mars stars Paul Manti, Victor Lewton, Adam West, and was directed by Byron Haskin, who also directed the 1953 War of the Worlds. Yes, the title contains the word Mars, which I guess is why it failed when it came out in 1964. The movie is about an American astronaut forced to crash land on Mars. He then has to survive until a rescue mission shows up. In the meantime, he discovers that an alien race has been mining the planet of ore using a group of slaves. He manages to rescue one who has oxygen pills so they can breathe without their space helmets. He names the slave Friday. They flee the hostile aliens, and they're eventually rescued by good old NASA. The special effects look pretty rough by today's standards. Think Forbidden Planet or Planet of the Apes or any sci-fi films before 2001 changed the game. But the film is thematically rich and interesting. I do not know if it served as one of Andy Weir's inspirations for writing The Martian, but the films certainly do share some, although not all, of the same concerns. Yeah, I mean, The Martian is basically Robinson Crusoe on Mars, not the movie, but so much as you know, kind of the same sort of narrative where someone has to survive, and there's a lot of concern with very specific numbers and ways to do that. As for the actual 1964 film, Robinson Crusoe on Mars, I did consider it. I like the movie. I actually find the effects really charming.
Yeah, me too. I'm not quite sure why he's dissing them.
I find the storytelling is a little pokey. I'm not sure we'd find it that much to talk about. I don't know. Maybe I should give it another look. Like I said, I do like the film and I would recommend it. I just don't know if we can fill an hour of a podcast with that particular film. But seek it out. It's a neat movie.
Yeah, I remember it as beautiful in a way, but rather sleepy. And of course, it does have kind of the Friday problem. I mean, anytime you're basing a movie on Robinson Crusoe, you've always got this like weird paternalism that comes in of spaceman American is going to find the slave who needs to be taught a good old American. Okay, well, we did consider it for the show, but John Carter, the reputation of John Carter and the degree to which some of us felt it needed to be rehabilitated kind of won out.
Keith, go ahead.
But Scott, we've actually got another email about suggested pairings for this week. Would you like to read that one?
Sure. Jen Small wrote in to alert us to one of Randall Monroe's excellent XKCD comic strips, which enthusiastically described The Martian as a book for people who wanted the entirety of Apollo 13 to be more like the scene where NASA has to, quote, connect this thing to this thing using this table full of parts or the astronauts will all die. She's surprised we didn't bring Apollo 13 into the conversation. Here's a quote from her letter. One of the things I find really moving and inspiring about both those films is the celebration of scientists, the spirit of exploration, and especially the celebration of engineers and problem solvers. I think stories where not everything goes right really brings the focus to all the work that goes into scientific advancement. I know that a lot of the discussion about the movie and the book focuses on Mark Watney and his fight for survival, but I found the portrayal of NASA, and particularly the engineers of JPL, pretty terrific. These are people who have to solve math and engineering problems in order to save a life, on an impossibly tight deadline. These are my heroes of scientific exploration.
I wonder if Jen's an engineer.
Good question.
Jen, you sound like an engineer.
Yeah, thank you for your service.
Yeah, I mean, there is certainly something to be said for just the degree to which both Andy Weir's The Martian and, well, to the degree that Andy Weir's The Martian relies on real science and real problem solving, and then to the degree that Ridley Scott in the movie trusted that information and trusted audiences to be able to get it. And I feel like the embrace of the movie kind of suggests that movie audiences are maybe a little smarter than a lot of movie producers give them credit for, and we could use some more science heroes in our films. All right, finally, in brief, we got a long, thoughtful letter from a listener who enjoyed discovering Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf through the podcast, but took issue with John Carter because of the ending. Genevieve?
Sojin Yadav writes, just when John Carter got ready to go back to Mars, I was finally completely into it and could not wait for the movie's climax. Then the movie ends. Just ends. When I watch a movie, I want a fully realized experience. Maybe if it was called John Carter Part 1, I would have known what I was getting into. But there is an art to the cliffhanger. Why is Empire Strikes Back so satisfying? Since none of you brought up the ending in any way, I am assuming it did not bother any of you as much as it did me. I would still like your thoughts on this movie's ending and cliffhangers in movies in general. I wonder what Sojin thinks of the end of Barton Fink.
I wonder what Sojin thinks of the end of All the President's Men, which, as we all know, is completely
unsatisfying. What about Remo Williams, The Adventure Begins?
Well, I mean, I think this is where the, you know, this is sort of the perils of setting out to make a trilogy and then your movie not doing well enough to do it. See, also The Golden Compass, which actually they remove the ending of that because they're saving it for the next film.
Yeah, and it ends with a speech that's like, all right, well, there are many adventures left to come. Here we go to meet those adventures.
Let's follow this golden compass wherever it will take us. you know, this is, you know, that's the problem. It's setting up for a sequel that's probably never going to happen.
Yeah, let's be practical about that. It's probably never going to happen. Taylor Kitsch's abs are just going to start like giving into gravity bit by bit over the years. It didn't even occur to me that the ending to John Carter was a problem. To me, the ending of John Carter is about the end of his struggles. He's been on this 10-year quest to get back to Mars. And then he gets back to Mars. Like, we don't really need to see his happy, uneventful life on a planet where the bad guys are all gone. Like, if there are going to be more adventures, that's great. But to me, the ending doesn't suggest any more adventures. They suggest that he's got what he wants.
I mean, he could have adventures.
I mean, if there were sequels.
If the film were successful enough, he could have adventures. but, in a way, though, I would say sometimes the cliffhangers, even good ones, are not that satisfying. I mean, I think my daughter probably enjoyed The Empire Strikes Back least of all of the Star Wars films that you saw. And I think part of that was like, this is not complete the story. This is, and you can't, it's not like television where you can expect something the next week. You kind of have to wait for it. And you may just wait forever.
Yeah. And we're getting more and more of those cliffhanger endings as we get more and more movies based on like lengthy book series. And I agree that there's sort of an art to it. But I mean, even if you go back to like the Lord of the Rings films, there's kind of that sense of movie after movie ending with, and now on to the next adventure, ... coming to your local Cinemaplex in 18 months. Yeah, it's sort of a hazard of a long and ongoing story. I think in some ways you've got to just be patient and understand that these things are all going to play differently 5 or 10 years like from now, like any film will. But at the same time, it's also going to play different 10 years later when there's still no John Carter from Mars 2. Well, as always, we appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. We may feature your response on a future episode or post it on our website. And that's it for this episode of The Next Picture Show. In the second half, we'll get into Hail Caesar, Scott will inevitably call Channing Tatum the Big Brisket, and Genevieve will inevitably call him Charming Potato. You'll also get to hear this.
I love that character so much. Yeah. And then, of course, when he's...
You're just a sucker for rope tricks.
Oh, the rope tricks.
Look for that later this week. Or better yet, subscribe to The Next Picture Show on iTunes or your podcaster of choice, and follow us on Twitter at NextPicturePod so you'll always know when a new episode drops. Until then, we'll be working on our script for the next show. Would like to just freeform these things without any planning. Would that it were so simple.
Would that it were so
that
simple.
Would that it were.
John, all my friends from the cotton fields away. Gone from the earth to a better land I know. I hear the gentle voices calling. Oh, Black Joe.